Hello everyone and welcome to the Dollar Auction Show. We have a very special episode for you today with a very special guest. But before that, a lot has been going on in the financial sector, both crypto and finance in general. So we could talk about that. Basically, what happened is that three banks collapsed in the sense that their liabilities at some point were much larger than their assets because their assets dropped in value pretty drastically in a pretty unexpected way. And the reason that happened is because the interest rate hikes that have been happening for the last year, we haven't seen such a rate, I think, ever. But definitely not recently. And so banks hold their assets in treasuries. When interest rates go up, the value of treasuries goes down. And so that's how the mismatch happened to be. But, you know, Alex and I have been speaking about this theme for many episodes now, which is the high interest rates are not sustainable. And I think that this is just like a harbinger of many things that could break if the Fed keeps increasing interest rates. And in fact, today, the Wall Street Journal had a big piece that was basically talking about the plans of the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates might be derailed because of these banks that collapse. Now, what's interesting is that people blame crypto. This has absolutely nothing to do with crypto. Basically, this problem is much, much bigger than crypto. Crypto is like a tiny industry. The problem is the global debt. The global debt to GDP is at huge levels. And now, I'm not a doom and gloom person. And as you'll see with our guest later on, there are many ways to interpret the data. So someone can look at the same data set and say, this is going to be really, really bad. And someone else can interpret it as it will be very good, because it's really hard to predict all the second order effects of different things. But on the face of it, the debt is so large that there's no way for the government to sustain 5% or something like that, because like more and more banks will fail and more industries will start failing. Currently, the employment is strong. But that's because, you know, we're still digesting the monetary surplus of COVID, all the money that was printed. You know, people are still relying on those funds. It's running out. And so at this level of interest rates, I'm not sure how long they can sustain it. Now, the good news is that the inflation print came in today and it was, you know, as expected, it was lower month over month. So that's fantastic. So basically the Fed can say, okay, inflation is coming down. We're just going to pause the interest rate increases and that's it. And that's fantastic for Bitcoin. In fact, you can see that in the last 3 or 4 days, Bitcoin is up, a huge amount, because Bitcoin, I think one of the best models to look at it is it's a hedge against the expansion of the monetary supply. Because it's a finite amount. And so it's basically the best hedge of debasement of currency. And so the idea is like, how long could the government sustain those high interest rates and the strength of the dollar? How long could that be sustained? And, you know, people still don't know. Maybe it will have another year of flat rates, but maybe more and more things will break. And at some point, they will have to bring the rates down, at which point it will be very, very good for Bitcoin. It will be good for tech stocks and all of the other sectors of the industry that were recently hit from the increase in interest rates. That being said, I think it's pretty healthy what the Fed did, because from time to time, the system has to get a shock to force itself to be more resilient and to de-risk itself. So we pretty much had a very, very long streak of the stock market only going up, and you know, the monetary base was just expanding and expanding and all the prices were going up. So now that we have high interest rates, now that people can actually put their money, you know, at a risk-free rate of 5%, so like to take on risk, you have to be compensated by a much higher interest rate, so like 10% maybe. And so then many companies basically stop having a reason to exist because they cannot return that capital. They can't make 10% per year. And so they don't get the investments. So it is healthy. But yeah, I think especially with the elections coming in 2024, it will be a big, you know, there's a big incentive for the government to just expand the monetary base. And because like, if Biden doesn't get reelected, it's not his problem anymore. And if he does get reelected, you know, then he doesn't have to worry about it because he's president and, you know, he's getting the second term. So in the sense, and even if somebody else runs, they'll promise tons of things and they'll promise lots of unfunded liabilities, which is basically like quantitative easing, which is almost the same as printing money. What's interesting is in the Wall Street Journal and other places, or even in the press release of the FDIC when they announced that one of the banks, Silicon Valley Bank, that basically went bankrupt, and the government had to decide, you know, do they bail out the depositors or not? So they decided to bail out the depositors, and but not the shareholders. And so they said in the press release, this won't cost the taxpayer anything. And I thought this is such a profound thing because on the one hand, you know, all of Twitter was like, oh, they're lying. Of course, it's going to cost. There's moral hazard, right? Like even if the shareholders get wiped out, but like the businesses don't get wiped out, then you don't have as strong of an incentive to run a healthy bank because you know that you can just run a bank that's less healthy and the customers will expect to be bailed out by the government. But that's just like the first order effect. The second order effect is that if you hadn't bailed out those banks again and again, maybe we would actually have innovation in the banking sector. Maybe, you know, there would be a free market and people could actually, you know, create products like actual fintech products on top of the fiat system. But no, they just keep the current system going. And so it will keep on going. And that's why, you know, hopefully Bitcoin is a hedge against that, but it will have to continue happening. Then there was also a big debate between VCs that were basically saying this will be a contagion. Like if Silicon Valley Bank fails, you know, startups will not be able to pay their employees. And so then, you know, it will create a crazy damage to the economy. So it will be a systemic risk. And then other people said, no, you're just protecting your own startups because you invested in these startups. And so you want the government, like you're usually libertarian and like now you want the government to intervene and save, you know, your companies. So that's kind of like hypocritical. And then they say, no, like we really thought there would be contagion. And like if we could help the FDIC make the right decision, then that's what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to raise the alarm. And then they have this back and forth of like, who's right and who's wrong. And again, I'm thinking from a higher perspective, the whole point, the whole problem was created by the fact that the Federal Reserve can set interest rates. Like, you know, so they keep them too low for too long, then they raise them too high, like in a very short period of time because like they're afraid of inflation. And then the collateral damage is like businesses that you don't know how to run your business. I mean, what people don't know about Silicon Valley, I mean, not many people spoke about it in the mainstream media of Silicon Valley Bank. A lot of its capital came in 2021 when startup valuations were crazy and there was so much money in the system that basically tons of startups were getting funded. And so they got all the deposits back then, and then they had to invest it in something. So they bought treasuries. And then what happened is because of all this money that they printed, that caused them to receive all of these deposits, then the government freaked out and is like, okay, we have to raise interest rates really quickly to stop inflation. And so it causes them, you know, to be bankrupt. But it's like they couldn't have known, or maybe they should have managed their risk better. But like, it's another example of the government having to solve a problem that they created. And with these words, we will go to our guest.
Privileged to have Dr. Larry Kotlikoff. He's an economics professor at Boston University. He's actually ranked by The Economist magazine as one of the world's top 25 most influential economists. Larry is also the president of Economic Security Planning and the founder of Maximize My Social Security and MaxFi. We would love to learn all about those. So Larry, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you guys.
So it's a little bit different because we typically jump into questions, but actually we Shimon, Larry and I were talking before this and we just decided to record. So want to get back to MaxFi and Maximize Social Security, but to catch everyone up because the conversation was so good, we were talking about FTX, the collapse and commingling of funds and what happened with Bernie Madoff. Why don't we continue that conversation now that we've introduced you, and then we'll go back and do the background and MaxFi and the typical interview.
So we were talking about whether, you know, how FTX really differs from Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers, where people put money, where even the local bank, where you put money into your account, might be a checking account or brokerage account, and then the entity takes that money and does whatever it wants to do with it, including it could be investing in some, making a loan to some company in which the principals of the bank actually have a position. I don't see that per se is illegal if we're talking about a bank or an investment bank, a commercial bank or bank. But FTX, you were telling me, Alex and Shimon, that FTX had an agreement with its investors that limited what they could do with the money that was deposited, that it could only be moved and spent on whatever with the written consent of the...
I pulled up their terms of service now here because there's a website that summarizes exactly what they violated. So it says here that all alleged crypto transfers from FTX to Alameda were explicitly forbidden under the terms of service. And specifically they say, you control the digital assets held in your account. Title to your digital assets shall at all times remain with you and shall not transfer to FTX trading. And then there's another bullet that says none of the digital assets in your account are the property of or shall or may be loaned to FTX trading. FTX trading does not represent or treat digital assets in user accounts as belonging to FTX trading. Now, the caveat here is that Alameda was not FTX trading. It was a hedge fund. And Sam says, oh, we just had an unlimited margin account, which is basically you can never get a margin call. So what is that if not commingling of the funds? You know, if you give an entity an unlimited margin account that can bankrupt you, you know, so I guess that's all I know. I don't know, Alex, if you know anything else.
Yeah, look, I'm obviously not an attorney. I find it very hard pressed that he won't be found guilty. Just today, there was papers filed against them, and there was 12 charges. Money laundering, wire fraud, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, et cetera, et cetera. And look, we knew the government was going to come in full force against them. That's not surprising. But it's, I would be shocked if he doesn't.
Why do you think he's pleading not guilty? What do you think is going on there?
I think they're going to, well, look, we don't know his kind of defense. I think everything that he's been doing and speaking publicly and saying, oh, my attorneys are telling me not to speak publicly, is all part of the game. And I think it's all part of his defense. I think it's, he's going out and saying he just made a mistake and he didn't know, and he wasn't aware how big the margin positions were. So, you know, I don't know what the legally, maybe it's not, you know, criminal. He's trying to think not for criminal intent.
Maybe he's going to say that his financial officer, CFO, made these transactions and he didn't know anything about them. And
well, there's no CFO. He's just going to say that he didn't, he didn't know what was going on. And the people in Alameda were creating these margin positions. The exposure was so high, he didn't know. You know,
but who's taking the money from? So Alameda just has the right to grab funds from these accounts.
So, I mean, there's not a big difference between grabbing funds from the account or having an unlimited margin trading account with the broker that has the customer funds. Because if the position goes against you, and they were leveraging, they were doing crazy stuff. So if the position goes against you, right, what's going to happen?
Could Alameda have been pledging the assets of FTX and not actually have gotten any cash transfers, just borrowed in order to cover its open position?
So it was even more insidious than that. So it usually would take some collateral, pledge it with a broker, right, and trade against it. But they traded on FTX. So FTX operated both the broker where the trading happened, right, and that had the customer funds. So Alameda, they didn't go to another broker to trade. They traded on the same broker. So there was no pledging.
And preferential terms. They were top of book all the time, right? So they were the ones getting preferential treatment and weren't margin called when they were supposed to be margin called. This is just, unfortunately, it's commingled with crypto. I spoke with a lot of folks on the Hill as part of my role with the exchange that I had in the last few months, and people commingle it. Republicans actually understand that it's different. Democrats love to commingle for, you know, to put regulatory pressure on the industry. But this is not a crypto issue. It's fraud. It's just fraud.
Is it commingling, or is it just somebody says, I'll give you a line of credit, and there's actually no assets to back that line of credit if you call on it? And I mean, he could argue that, right? That probably. You know, I never used my depositors' money ever. I just gave them a line of credit. I thought we'd have enough profits to provide it. We just weren't able to do it, and they traded against it.
It gets deeper than that. So they created this token called the FTT, which is the FTX token. They basically used that token as collateral against many of the loans. The problem with that is the buyer of the token, the bid in the market of the token, was FTX and Alameda. I don't remember what percentage of the market, but Alameda was like, call it 70-80%. Don't quote me on the numbers, but it wasn't just a simple majority. It was a vast majority. There was a lot that went wrong there, and a lot of the way they were inflating their value was saying, hey, we have X billion dollars in collateral. Well, you don't if you're the buyer of your own collateral, right? And so the way, this is important actually for our audience, the way markets work and understanding depth of markets. If it's a thin market, a price move up and down, a small volume move up and down can move the price significantly, right? Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't a market there to be had, and all of that value is just paper value. So
let's just move this away from FTX for a second and say we're Bear Stearns, back when Bear Stearns was still alive, and Bear Stearns makes a provides a line of credit to let's say Lehman Brothers when Lehman was alive, and it says, yeah, you can borrow up to $20 billion or $20 trillion and just call when you need the money. And then Lehman gets into trouble, calls the line of credit, and Bear Stearns doesn't have the money. Was their commitment illegal? Or maybe that's what they're going to argue. Maybe this is what Sam Bankman-Fried is going to argue, that this was just, we could honor the lines of credit, but we weren't able to, and that's just business outcomes.
I guess we'll see in court. I mean, what's interesting about this market, I was on a panel at a conference in London a couple of months ago, and every time there's a new technology that's a breakthrough, there's always tons of fraud because the existing systems don't know how to deal with this new technology. So I remember the dot-com bubble, right? When people were like buying ads from each other, inflating their balance sheets and going public, right? That doesn't work today. But it took a big crisis for all the investors to understand. So this industry is so new that not many people know how to treat these things. I mean, in your example, it's like if Bear Stearns had a derivative of their stock that's a function of the trading volume, which was the FTT token. And they pledged that derivative as collateral, borrowed cash against it, then used this cash to do trades that went against them. And then you get a double whammy. The collateral value shrinks to zero instantly. And like it everything went wrong, basically. So I guess it'll be found out in the courts.
It's like Ponzi cubed, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Yep, absolutely.
Exactly. No, just to bring it kind of higher up, this is, Shimon and I talk about this all the time, because FTX was just basic fraud. But there were other collapses within the industry, namely one hedge fund called Three Arrows Capital, which is very similar. The analogy there is long-term capital in the 90s, which, you know, smartest guys in the room started trading, collapsed. Now, within crypto, there is no buyer of last resort. It's kind of the ultimate Austrian school of economics versus kind of Keynesian school of economics A/B test. So when there's a collapse, it's like, hey, don't mess up or else bad things will happen. It's like, okay, you messed up. You pushed the envelope too much. Now you're about to see. And there's no Fed to step in. So the collapses are hard and they're vicious. But it truly just takes out all the bad players. Now, the market is pretty much done collapsing. I mean, all the leverage that was there and that was based on opaqueness is gone. And by the way, the interesting part is opaque firms that collapse are all centralized, regular kind of TradFi firms using crypto. All the decentralized finance untouched for 3 or 4 years, works by itself, no person is running it. But it's the Austrian school, right? It collapses down to zero. No one bails out the bad players. They all go bankrupt. And then arguably we'll see whether the industry has a V-shaped recovery faster than the globe, our kind of more managed global economy that has a Fed, that has people, you know, pulling different levers to smooth out the economy. And maybe this is an interesting A/B test of, you know, which school is actually right, which we haven't had before. I don't know if you have an opinion on that, coming from an economics perspective.
Well, I mean, if obviously fraud can impact any, you know, some allegations of fraud and over leverage and lack of proper adequate rating and regulators on the basically being bribed or revolving door situation. All these things were alleged in the 2008 recession. None of them turn out to be true ex post. There's a column an article I wrote at Kotlikoff.net. It's called The Big Con. If you go to Kotlikoff.net and click on articles and then look for con in the search bar. And I wrote it in reference to the movie and book, The Big Short, because it turns out that The Big Short was a big con. That actually, The Big Short was telling all these tales about what went south or all this bad behavior in leading up to the Great Recession. None of it turns out to be true 10 years later when you look at the data. And with Bitcoin and these other cryptocurrencies, you know, a lot of the collapse is obviously due to rumors and just, you know, what happened with FTX, but also, you know, that certainly didn't help. But Bitcoin was, crypto was in trouble in the sense of having dropped a lot before FTX collapsed. So then the question is, you know, why has it had such wild swings, and why do we have, you know, I heard 20,000 cryptocurrencies. I don't know if that's the number that's out there, but clearly we can't have 20,000 currencies because the, you know, if people lose faith in one currency, it's just inherently incredibly unstable to have. The thing that pins down the value of a, imagine the U.S. had euros and dollars, and we could pay our taxes in dollars, in euros, as well as dollars, as well as yuan or rubles. Well, the relative valuation, there would be nothing to kind of anchor the dollar. So if everybody decided overnight that nobody wanted to hold the dollar or there was some rumor about a super efficient counterfeiter machine that could counterfeit dollars. Everybody would drop the dollar like a hot potato, and we'd be moving into euros because that would function just as well. So until the U.S. government says we will accept Bitcoin to pay taxes, it may not, or any some cryptocurrency, even it could even be a Federal Reserve, a U.S. government crypto electronic currency that gives it some underpinning of you need to have this thing for sure in your possession come April 15th. So I think that I'm a big fan of the idea. I don't know if you guys know, but I wrote a book called Jimmy Stewart is Dead after in 2010 about the Great Recession. And I was talking about, I basically got conned into thinking that most of what was being told to us at the time was true. So I wrote an economist's take on the Great Recession, including a lot of facts that, quote, facts that were allegations that weren't true about the housing market going up, you know, going bananas, but it wasn't really when you look at the data. Everything that was said about the Great Recession, including the fact that it was great, it actually was a rather no bigger than the prior big recession, which was 1981 to 82, same increase in unemployment, 10%, same, pretty much the same reduction in output by about 3%. So there's nothing really great about the Great Recession except the hype. So anyway, I wrote this book, but the key part of the book is that there's a discussion of having what I call limited purpose banking, where the entire financial sector is equity finance, so that there's no leverage of the financial companies. It's really modern Islamic banking, if you like. And so a company like Bear Stearns would not have any debt on its books. It would just be selling equity. And if its investments in subprimes or whatever did poorly, the shareholders who are holding Bear Stearns either directly or through a mutual fund would take the hit, and Bear Stearns would never have gone under. None of the 10,000 equity finance mutual funds in our country had any trouble during the Great Recession. The 10,000 banks, had, you know, 17 of them in the U.S. Were quasi-bank institutions like insurance company, like AGI, had major trouble. So Bitcoin is, so one of the equity finance mutual funds here would be a cash mutual fund, which you just hold cash. And Bitcoin is like a cash mutual fund, if you like. And that's why I like the idea of that. Because it's a way to just have your cash and have it perfectly secure and not be subject to any institution failing, unless they steal the money, which FTX is an example of. I mean, the best thing would be have cash mutual funds or cash deposits issued by the Federal Reserve. In other words, you could open up a checking account with the Federal Reserve, and then your money is 100% safe. And then everything else you invest in, like a mortgage company would not be borrowing money to lend it. It would be selling shares, mutual fund shares, taking the money and buying mortgages. And if the mortgages default, well, the shareholders take it on the head. So that's actually the covered bond market to a large extent as it operates. And it was originated in 1792 by Frederick the something third of Denmark. I think the year is pretty close. And the mortgage market is very much of an equity financed system as opposed to a debt financed mortgage market. Anyway, so we can have all our entire financial system insulated from any future panics. And if you look at the history of financial recessions in the U.S. or recessions in the U.S., almost all of them have the word crisis or panic associated with them, because, and they're all triggered by this mobile equilibria. This, everybody gets the idea that Bear Stearns is going down, and Bear Stearns goes down because there's a run on the, there was a run on the Bear Stearns by the other banks. It wasn't the households running on the banks. It was the banks running on the banks. And let me just say this last thing. I know I'm talking a lot, but I learned about Bear Stearns going under on the Thursday before it went under on the, where they declared bankruptcy, or where they sold for $2 a share on like Sunday night that weekend, thanks to the Federal Reserve buying up their worst subprime, their supposedly worst subprimes, and then getting JP Morgan to buy up the company for $2 a share, which was less than the value of their building in New York. So I learned about this because I'm sitting next to a guy on a plane. He's a broker, works for a hedge fund or something. He said, "Do you know Bear Stearns is going to go under this weekend?" I said, "No. How do you know?" He said, "Look at this text." It was a text sent by one of these major hedge fund companies who sent out a text that says they're pulling their money out of Bear Stearns and that they don't trust its viability. And they may well have had a short position and nobody from our government ever decided to look and check. So they may have talked down, they may have actually created the run, just like this other guy that other currency, the crypto exchange, you guys know his name, I don't know, announced that FTX was in trouble, and bingo, it became in trouble. That's the kind of multiple equilibria we know exists in the financial system that we want to eliminate with limited purpose banking. But anyway, you guys respond.
Yeah, no, so there's a lot of things to respond to here. I'll just say the main thing is, like, I completely agree with you about the 20,000 cryptocurrencies. I actually don't like the term cryptocurrency because Bitcoin, if you look at the original white paper, it basically said an electronic peer-to-peer cash system. And so the cash system is basically to say cash is what people use to store value in, you know, when we were on the gold standard. And so I think the main thing that Bitcoin does is it basically creates a monetary policy that competes with the monetary policy of countries. And then people can decide, you know, do they use it as a store of value, or do they use stocks or real estate or just cash US dollars or yen or euro, to your point, as stores of value. Now, what's really interesting, both Alex and I really love the US and we're very bullish on the US as a whole. You know, we're immigrants here. Silicon Valley is a great example of, like, you see the top CEOs of top corporations that are immigrants. You don't see this in Europe. And another thing that I really like about the US is, like, their monetary policy was relatively very good. That's why that's one of the reasons why the dollar is a store of value for people outside of the US. But I wanted to pivot this thing and ask about your paper that I really enjoyed called The Future of Global Economic Power, that talks a little bit about the US versus other parts of the world and what's expected for them going forward. So what would you say were the main kind of interesting points in that paper?
So this paper is also posted. It's posted at kotlikoff.net under articles. It's called The Future of Global Economic Power, as you said. And what we did is put together a model with 18, all the countries of the world combined into 18 regions. And I have a whole bunch of co-authors, several Russian co-authors from the Gaidar Institute in Moscow I was working with before the war, and some American former grad students. And anyways, big effort over many years to put together a model with something like a million equations, 18 regions, all calibrated to the UN demographics and the fiscal policies, fiscal data from the IMF. So you take this model, and it's a realistic model where it's called a life cycle, dynamic life cycle model, where people don't, you know, they are not altruistic towards future generations, which there's no evidence of. They just live for themselves, and if they die with money, they leave it to their kids, but otherwise they're not really trying to make the quest. But anyway, you have high and low skilled people, middle skilled people. So you simulate this forward, and you include a catch-up productivity growth of each region relative to the US based on the historic record. And you find that even though China's population is going to shrink by a third because of the, at least according to the UN projections, because that one child policy has these implications. And even though they lifted that, people are still not having more than one kid, basically. So their population is going to drop by 400 million. Our population is going to go up by about a third by the end of the century, by about 120, the size of the Philippine population. So we're growing demographically. They're shrinking. Right now, our shares of GDP, well, as in 2017, that's our base year, they were both about 16% of world GDP. The EU was about 18%. And if you go to the end of the century, just run this model forward, you find that China has 27% of world output. India has 11% of world output. The US has 11% of world output. And the EU has 8% of world output. So India and China together have almost 40% of world output. And that's actually based on a rather conservative projection of productivity catch-up. If you use the last 20 years of data, China ends up with a third of world output at the end of the century. That's interaction of high productivity and, well, productivity that catches up with the U.S., but also a population that will still be at the end of the century 2.5 times the U.S. And then the other interesting thing is that Africa's population is going to explode by the tune of almost 2.5 China's, and the Middle East. And those regions are not going to be that important in terms of GDP shares because their productivity is not catching up rapidly. It's basically staying, even with the U.S. So productivity is the basic bottom line that we're finding so important for that interacting with, well, demographics matter, but productivity is kind of fundamental.
Can I pressure test this a little bit? I'm going to use a Mike Tyson quote because I'm very sympathetic to what you're doing.
Face, you can.
Yeah, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face, right? You know that quote. Yeah. And I'm sympathetic because I used to work at Microsoft and at the Boston Consulting Group. I did M&A, and all of M&A, you do due diligence and you create models and you expect that to be within some sort of deviation of the model. Having been in the U.S., I think there are undercurrents that the U.S. has, specifically the U.S., that I think are underestimated. And that undercurrent is the way we've been able to structure our society. And that's universities, that's nonprofits, the government, entrepreneurship, tax code, culture, ethos of capitalism, where entrepreneurship can actually sprout, right? And so, and I believe that entrepreneurship innovation is ultimately drives productivity. And a great example of that is look what's happening with AI and like ChatGPT with Microsoft. But the fact that right now, today, February 23rd, 2023, within 5 minutes, one of us can ask a chatbot to create a fairly sophisticated website and write all the HTML, and it will output it for you. So the old days of design and designers and coders, we're going to just lift up everyone's productivity. Here's where I push back on this. And I've worked with Chinese companies, and this is true for China. It's true for, Russia, brilliant people, truly just academically and raw horsepower. But the culture is not one of entrepreneurship. The culture one is of a top-down system that's a follower. In fact, when we were in business school, and I'm sure you've seen this, one of the most fascinating charts that I've ever seen was China's export-import chart. And they both move up and down in the exact same way within a certain, within a certain difference between. So there's an order that comes into China. They buy the inputs and they give you the order. But the value is the manufacturing. They can produce very, very well. But I haven't seen innovation, global innovation stemming from China. Definitely no global innovation in recent years stemming from Europe. We can say Alibaba, right? We can say Tencent and WeChat and all these other programs. And I would argue
these are copies, by the way. All these are, I always ask, Russia and China, what's one product that someone in the West would buy of their own free will without subsidies, without any incentives? Just like, oh, this is a Russian product, really great. Or Chinese product, awesome. You know?
I grant you, but I guess you can still have, even if you're doing a copycat economy, which is what you're claiming, you can still, if you have enough people and you're equally productive by copying, you can have a Navy that's 2.5 times the U.S. Navy. You can have an army that's a zillion times bigger, and you can have all this stuff that can lead you to be able to push the world around and be the hegemon. So I guess the question is, what is the question?
I'll give you, Alex, that
U.S. is really unique, got a fantastic environment for innovation. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned this to you guys before or whether you know this, but I've been working. The reason I have co-authors on this paper about the future global economic power that are Russian is I've been working with the Gaidar Institute in Moscow, which is their major think tank, with a set of economists there. I was working for that. I was going there 2 weeks a year for 6 years between 2013 and 2019. We did a number of projects. I understand that culture, but there's also certainly brilliant Russian economists, and many actually have emigrated to the U.S., by the way.
Yes.
Alex, you guys are both immigrants from...
We have Ukraine here, Bulgaria, and Israel with Shimon. So we're part of...
I was actually born in Bulgaria and escaped as soon as communism collapsed.
Well, I'll give you a quick statement and a question about this, right? But here's my statement. The proof to me is in the pudding. It's like I felt it growing up my whole life. And again, Russians are brilliant mathematicians, brilliant economists, just brilliant. But the country can't get their stuff together. So look at the war in Ukraine. The army is falling apart because of grift, because of just corruption through and through, right? Or top down. And this is, by the way, lots of thoughts. And on the side of why we believe in crypto so much, especially Bitcoin, it's a decentralized system. The U.S. decentralized system is a more resilient system than a top-down command and control system, which is, you know, Russians are great in space, great in, you know, in science and technology, Chinese as well. When the government says, hey, we need to do X, Y, and Z, go gymnastics, right? And then you pump out great gymnasts or great tennis players, but that's it. So I don't see the U.S. ceding its power, given the population trends and given just the culture. But let's assume we do. I mean, it's neither here nor there. We're arguing about hypotheticals and counterfactuals, and we can't do that. But if there is a multipolar world, do you believe it's ultimately a good thing for humanity and the U.S. or a bad thing?
Well, okay, just... one thing to say about this discussion, and I'll answer that question. China's productivity, relative productivity used to be about, if you go back 20, 30 years, it was about 3% of the U.S. level. Now it's about 25%, 2020, in terms of average wages, just comparison of wages with some normalization. Now, if we break into polar world, would that work just as well? As long as we don't have a war between these worlds, I think trade's important, but it's not essential. I have a Substack newsletter that I encourage everybody to subscribe to. It's called LarryKotlikoff.substack.com. So just Kotlikoff.net, you can click on it and you can sign up for it, and you can sign up for free.
We'll link it in the show notes for everyone.
Yeah, and I just did I put out something called the Financial Riddler, which is a set of questions, like a quiz about economics or finance or demographics or political economy issues. And I did one just yesterday about China. And because I was thinking, well, we're having all this confrontation with China, and we think we have this leverage over China. We can extract good behavior out of China by threatening, just cut off trade. So how dependent is China on trade with the U.S. and how dependent is the U.S. on trade with China? It turns out that our Chinese imports into the U.S. are a small share of our biggest. We import more from other parts of Asia and from the European Union than we do from China. And China's imports are maybe 3% as a share of U.S. GDP. And our exports to China are about 1% of our GDP. And then if you go look at China, China's exports to the U.S. around 3% of GDP, and its imports are even smaller. So if we did a complete embargo on China and they weren't able to adjust at all, they'd lose 3% of GDP. Can you live without 3% of GDP? Absolutely. That's, you know, Russia can live with 25% less GDP and everybody's equally happy. They know how to suffer. This is a country that is very good at suffering, as a comparative advantage in suffering. So so we could have a bipolar world where I think the living standards would be pretty much the same as would occur otherwise. And then I think, Alex, you're raising the question is, could those other countries keep up, technologically speaking, because the U.S. is so innovative and has this culture of innovation? And maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe they can just copy. They can see what we're doing. And, you know, China has a bullet train between Shanghai and Beijing. The U.S. has no bullet train. Shanghai has incredible skyscrapers that we have nothing like in the U.S., as far as I can tell. They have, you know, Hong Kong, look at that city. I mean, it's just amazing. We have nothing that's so clean and so beautiful and so modern. They don't use cash at all for transactions. They figure, and that means that they've gotten rid of the underground economy, and they've got a much bigger tax base because of that, because nobody can hide their income, because everything is being done electronically. You can't go to China and actually buy anything on the street or in a store unless you have a Chinese bank account and a cell phone app that, you know, can draw from that. So
yeah, I mean, this was a conversation. So again, I was 10 years in San Francisco before coming here to DC, and this was literally all we were talking about, like no bullet train from San Francisco to LA, homeless people on the street, you know, all of that. So I totally get that. Definitely an interesting model. I mean, especially like democracy versus more authoritarian regimes, if they're well run, you know, you see Singapore and Dubai is great examples. So yeah, a lot to think about there. I really want to use our time though to ask you about your other paper that I read that I found really fascinating, which was about the US fiscal gap. So, you know, many people now are talking about the environment. Basically, we're kind of in unprecedented times because like we have inflation, but like the government can't do what they did like in the 80s, like to raise interest rates a lot because they have so much debt, both globally and in the US. So can you walk us through kind of the main insights of the US fiscal gap?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Alex, I mentioned that Russia had this capacity because both of you guys were living close to Russia, that they have the capacity to suffer. The US does not have a capacity to suffer. The politicians don't let anybody suffer, especially older people who are voters. So we've been engaged in a massive Ponzi scheme, starting with Eisenhower, who really jacked up the Social Security system. And this, you know, the basic story here is you take from young people and you give to old people and they vote for you. And then you tell young people, don't worry, when you're old, we'll get you to vote for us by letting you grab from your kids an even bigger amount. And this is a Ponzi scheme and it's been going on. And some of the money, and Congress has realized that if you grab money from young people and you call it taxes, and then you promise them transfer payments in the future, like Medicare benefits, healthcare benefits, and government pensions, Social Security, and you make them generous, they won't care that you're calling it taxes because it comes with a payback. If you instead had used the word borrowing, I'm borrowing from you young people, and I'm going to pay you back in the form of servicing this borrowing with a high interest rate, maybe, or just at a regular market rate, but I'll also throw in some transfers on top of that. Okay. That language would, changing that language would put this off the books liability to pay back the transfer payments. It would have put it on the books. So basically the official numbers we're looking at, the debt numbers, are a matter of our linguistics, our choice of labels. And that means that they're meaningless. So if you go to the Congressional Budget Office and look at all their historical data on taxes and deficits and debt and transfer payments, all those numbers are as meaningful as time is in physics. Time, we know, has an infinite number of measurements in physics, thanks to, Einstein's relativity theory told us that. And distance is also completely undefined by physics. Well, in economics, the equations of economics do not pin down how to talk about the equations of economics. And that's why it's arbitrary. So the fiscal gap is a label-free measure. It says, I don't care how you label the money you're taking from people. And I don't care. The fiscal gap says, I don't care about that. I don't care about how you, what you call the payments you make to people. We're going to just look at the outlays, no matter what they're called, figure out the present, project them into the infinite horizon. And we can use the CBO's numbers on that. Congressional Budget Office projections extend their projections. And we can take the projections of receipts, and we can take the difference in present value. And that is a share of the present value of GDP is 7.7%. If you go to kotlikoff.net, there's a spreadsheet called the fiscal gap under articles. You can pull it up. I just did it the other week, about 2 weeks ago. And it shows that we're short 7.7% of GDP for the end of time. Okay. That's our fiscal problem right there. Label free, puts everything on the books. What does that translate into? Well, if you wanted to just keep the path of outlays the same and just raise receipts, it would correspond to a 47% increase in every federal tax through the end of time. Or you could cut spending, keep the tax path, the receipts path fixed, and cut the spending. How much would that have to be? A third through the end of time. So we have a massive fiscal problem. Our country is insolvent. So yes, Alex and Shimon, we have certain advantages that you have experienced. You guys have experienced on Wall Street and in the tech centers of this country. But we also have some things that China may be in the same kind of long-term fiscal shape, but they can easily tell people, sorry, no healthcare, sorry, no pensions. And we, it's okay.
We need to, can we have you back? I would love to leave off of this because this is a fascinating discussion. I would love, maybe you can even, do this very soon and we can talk after we stop recording here.
Sure. But let me just say, just conclude. So we have this terrible dilemma, which goes far beyond the official debt that Congress is arguing about, defaulting on. And my view is that we need to, there is a way out that doesn't involve massive increase in taxes or a massive cut in spending. And let's talk about it next time.
And because I would love to hear it, this is a perfect cliffhanger for our audience. We should talk about it next time. And I'm going to plug one thing. Shimon's actually writing a book about this. And him and I talk about this a lot. For us, just some tea leaves for next time. It's about growth. And it's about bringing down the cost of these services. So can you provide the same services for lower cost? So because
take health. Yeah.
Yeah. Take healthcare. Exactly.
Healthcare is, I'll just list teaser, 18% of GDP we're spending on healthcare. Sweden's spending 11%. We're ranked 21st in quality. They're ranked 4th in quality. So you can get better quality for less. And that is more than our fiscal gap. I mean, well, the difference is about, is almost our entire fiscal gap. So just fixing healthcare the right way, which we can talk about how to do that next time, is one solution.
Let's do this. Next time we'll talk about this. We'll link your kotlikoff.net down in the show notes, as well as the papers. For the audience, please like, subscribe, and give us your feedback. We will definitely have you back. Let's leave it off here.
Yeah, and Larry, is there anything that we can tell our viewers to go to beyond kotlikoff.net? You mentioned the newsletter. Is there any other place where you would want to send people to see your work?
There's larrykotlikoff.substack.com, and then I have the software company. We have these two incredibly powerful tools. If you're just interested in getting Social Security right, which everybody should figure out how to maximize their lifetime benefits, there's a $39 tool called MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com. And then if you want to do lifetime planning, financial planning, the way an economist would do it, it's called Maxify.com. It also does the Social Security calculations for you. You don't need to have both programs. That's the basic program that's $109. And the premium version that shows you, lets you look at investment risk, and including figuring out a way to have a stable a floor to your living standard and just have upside risk, which you guys would be interested in. And we can talk about that in another
show.
Let's
do that.
That's called Upside Investing. It does that too. That's Maxify.com, M-A-X-I-F-I.com.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kotlikoff. We'll link to all of these tools in our show notes. And also, the book is fantastic. We can talk about that next time.